Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
This week, we have Marie Delafant, and we're going to talk about autonomy, boundaries, and consent. So Marie is a former evangelical missionary to Mexico, now an agnostic atheist, secular humanist, and activist. She hosts the Everyone's Autonomous podcast, discussing themes of autonomy through a post-religion lens and the process of reintegration into the world, now that we are just apes and not the chosen children of God. Marie is also a photographer with a humanist twist, as well as a life coach with a speciality in ethical non-monogamy. So Marie, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Marie, you're...
Should I unmute myself?
Yes, there we go.
This is the point where you want me to talk, right?
Exactly.
Cool. All right, you want me to take it?
Yeah, welcome.
All right.
Marie, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm nervous as hell.
Sure.
I'm so happy to see you all here. I can see all of your faces, and I'm so grateful. I see a lot of faces I know. Some people I met at the Journey Free retreat, a couple of people I know through my podcast, and I'm just so delighted to see everyone here. Thank you so much for attending, and I hope that you can get something out of it. You know, at the beginning, Eric said, make sure to grab a paper and a pen. I'm going to reiterate that's going to be an integral part. So with that said, I just kind of want to also introduce myself to you all. My name is Marie Delafont. It's not actually Marie Delafont. My real name is Marie LePage, but when I do activism work, I like to use my pseudonym, but I don't mind saying it with my lips. So as they mentioned, I do life coaching work for ethical non-monogamy, for recovery from toxic religious experiences, photographer, podcast host, speaker. I also, a lot of you might have already run across Dave Warnock from Dying Out Loud. I'm his manager and I am his personal photographer and I travel with him. And so if you know him, I'm pretty closely associated with him. And I also do virtual assistant work for Dr. Marlene Wynell. So that's just kind of the world that I'm in. I'm white. I am cisgender. I'm female. Grew up in America, in Minnesota. And I live in a home here near Minneapolis with my partner of 10 years. And I have two cats and I love them. So that's a little bit about me. So today, we're going to dive in and talk about autonomy, boundaries, and consent. Autonomy is a big topic for people coming out of religion and really for a lot of folks because our culture and narratives don't encourage a lot of autonomy. A lot of the messages we receive in media promote kind of a codependent relationship with people. So I want to talk about paradigm shifts. Have any of you gone through a huge paradigm shift where you thought you had everything kind of figured out about the world and all of a sudden something blew up in your brain? Like maybe you thought, you know, trans women aren't women and all of a sudden, boom, you got educated and you're like, oh my God, I had no idea. Or say you believe that there was a God in the sky who could see everything that you thought and was going to punish you every time you touched your naughty bits. Like, and then all of a sudden one day you realize that that's not true. And so you had to go through this extreme paradigm shift, this cognitive shift of having to remap all of your synapses and in the entire framework that you view the world. So I'm imagining a lot of us have gone through at least one very intense paradigm shift. Yeah. And for those of us who come from a religion, usually we've at least gone through one. And one thing I've noticed among people who are recovering from toxic religious experiences is that there's this tendency to be like, I did it. Like, I stopped believing in God. I'm good to go now. I've got everything figured out. I'm like on my game. And like, I was kind of there for a while. I was like, oh, they're all dumb. I'm smart because I figured this out. But then And I thought that's what the rest of my life was going to be like. I figured it out and they're the dumb ones. But slowly I've been going through more and more paradigm shifts. I thought that was the only one I was going to have to go through and that I was done. And that was the big trauma. But it turns out I went through a lot more shifts, such as, like, as I've kind of hinted at earlier, going from a monogamous worldview to a polyamorous worldview. I used to believe in the war on drugs. Now I enjoy cannabis on the reg. I used to be afraid of fear, and now I engage fear. These are all huge paradigm shifts that I've gone through, a big shift in the way that I view the world. And now I'm kind of,
Go
ahead. Yeah.
I'll tell you one of the big paradigm shifts that I had, and it was surprisingly, it was too late and like, it should have been much earlier, but, you know, I'm a white male. I can walk around. I don't have a problem. I don't really think about, you know, what I necessarily have to do to protect myself when I'm out. But when I started listening to, some women's stories and kind of how they think, or how many of them think, like, I have to carry my keys in a certain way in order to defend myself. I have to make sure that I have these defensive mechanisms in my purse. I have, and I'm always kind of sizing people up as I'm walking by them, or sometimes I even have to cross the street if I'm, like, when I got that, it was a complete, like, holy crap, this is an entirely different world
that the
other half of our population lives in. And it was just, my world got so much bigger, like my understanding. And I had my life didn't change, but my thinking totally changed. And I was able to empathize and I guess I did change a little bit. I acted differently. I stopped doing some normal stuff that, that I can understood was not helpful or conducive to making the people feel safe.
Right. And you were able to do that because you listened to stories that weren't yours. And that's the goal, you know, if we're going to come back to Mandisa Thomas and Candace Gorham were saying is that we need to listen to these stories that aren't ours and know that those are true experiences, regardless of whether we experience them or not. Mm-hmm. So that's how these paradigm shifts can happen, by listening to someone else's story, like really listening to someone else's story and experience, and knowing that just because you didn't experience it doesn't mean it's not real and it's not something that should be addressed. So these are all these kinds of paradigm shifts that we might go through in life. And I quickly did want to kind of give you the background on my first paradigm shift. So the first paradigm shift for me started when I was 13. I was raised in evangelical Christianity in Minnesota. It was the white Jesus Christianity, because turns out he's not white. Surprise! So I was raised in that kind of Christianity, and I started doubting when I was 13. But the fear that particular strain of Christianity it puts in you, where you have a threat on your life at all times. If you don't think the right thing, you will die permanently, and it'll be forever painful. There was this constant threat of death. And so I never felt very safe to explore those doubts. And so I doubled down and I became a missionary with a very extreme form of Christianity called Youth with a Mission in Mexico. And so I was doing that work for 2 years, but the cognitive dissonance would not abate. And I eventually left missions and started a slow journey of deconversion. And then the following 12 years or so, all I could see was the nose in front of my face. I had so much trauma from that experience. And only recently have I been able to kind of like, whoa, what's going on here? But I'm getting ahead of myself. But that was the first paradigm shift that I went through. And I imagine some of you folks might be able to relate to that. So that said, I think that when one is traumatized, we use that word very liberally. One of the features of trauma is in the scenario, the person not having power over what's happening. There's a loss of power, of control, and the trauma is because you couldn't stop it, you couldn't control it. And in that, in religion, at least in the form that I was a part of, that is the trademark. In fact, they celebrate not having control. They celebrate giving up control, relinquishing control, letting go of things, and trusting someone else to take care of it. And so if that's a form of religion that you relate to, you're going to be potentially struggling with getting back in touch with your self-trust, your autonomy, your capacity, and your right to advocate for the things that belong to you. So my proposal, my thesis, if you will, is that exploring the themes of autonomy can help us all heal from these trauma, from this trauma, if that's something that you relate to. So we're going to explore autonomy. And the slide that you can put up, Eric, is the one that starts with TLDR, which means, for all the young kids out there, they know what this means. But for the older folks, it's too long didn't read. TLDR means too long didn't read. So if you check out at any point during this conversation, you get lost, you get bored, you're frantically trying to take notes and you can't keep up, don't worry about it, because remember that anything I say from this point on is the same thing again and again and again. All I'm saying today is that you have autonomy and so does everyone else. So if you remember nothing,
I'm 24 and I had no idea of what TLDR meant. So thank you for the
notes. Well, as a hip person, you're welcome for teaching you what that means.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're so welcome. So that is the tagline of my podcast, because for a lot of us, and you can switch off the slide, for a lot of us, as we're coming out of religion, we do get a little bit more familiar with the sense of like, you can close the slides altogether. We get excited about the idea of autonomy. We're like, what? We get to have sex now? Like with whoever we want? Pro. Or like, what? We get to like not have to go to church? What? We don't have to wear a skirt? What? We can cut our hair? What? And like, we get all excited about the freedom that is found when we leave religion. And that's autonomy. And everyone's excited about that. And there are so many podcasts out there about like, yeah, we got autonomy back from religion. But the thing that I want to bring up to folks like ourselves is that if we're so excited and we're so invested in the value of our autonomy, because what we're saying to ourselves is, I'm autonomous because I'm a human being. And we're like, yeah, that feels good. So it therefore follows that if I am autonomous because I'm a human being, it therefore follows that everyone else who is a human being is also autonomous. And so the things that we have access to, the autonomy that we exercise, the freedoms that we have, everyone should have. And so as someone coming out of religion, coming to terms and embracing and celebrating your autonomy, let's celebrate that and let's extend it out just a little bit further. Let's dip our toe into humanism. Let's dip our toe into advocating for the fighting for the autonomy of other people, because if it's so important to us, it is absolutely essential to everyone. We are not the only ones who are autonomous. We're not the only ones that are human beings. And so this is kind of the thesis that I'm putting out for you all. So I think, did I say all those things? Yeah, like just taking a look at my notes. Yeah, and in doing that, reconnecting with our autonomy is hard. It took me a long time. It took me like 12, 13 years after deconverting. And I thought the easiest part was going to be deconverting. I was like, once I get rid of this stuff, I'll be good to go. Turns out I had to pay a lot of money to therapists and clinics to just get to the point where I am now, where I'm enjoying living. You know, and I don't think there's enough focus on that period of time that needs to be focused on for healing from religion itself. And yeah, then in the necessity of that to be able then to turn outwards and to see the world around you. Because I honestly don't think that I could have in those 12 years where I just didn't even know why I was alive and what the point of life was and like who I am. I couldn't have looked around and been like, oh, there's racism, let me go take care of that. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't look outside myself. And so some of us are holding a lot of intense trauma, and it's essential that we take that time to attend to that so that we can support the autonomy of other people who have been fighting for that autonomy this entire time. And we didn't even know it because we were stuck in religion and in our ways of looking at the world. Not all of you, of course. I'm speaking in generalizations, so if what I say is untrue, disregard. So the question is, how do we heal? And I propose that we discover autonomy. Christianity, if you came from Christianity or a belief system similar to that, tells us that our heart is wicked. It tells us that we can't trust anyone except for God. I posit, I propose, I theorize that we are not wicked. We are, in fact, wonderful, beautiful human beings who are messy. We're just apes, and we're just figuring it out as we go, and we don't need to hold ourselves to these standards of being perfect anymore. And that we can just go eat a banana and apologize to people when necessary and just seek to grow. And that's all that anyone can ask of us, because there's no God. Well, that might be too much to say right now. That there doesn't seem to be any, like, you know what I'm saying, overarching power. So Eric, you can put up the next slide. Something that has helped me find my place in the world, to contextualize and to give some girth to the sense of my own autonomy, is to place myself within the timeline that I actually am living in. Instead of saying God created the earth and now here I am and my job is just to worship him, now I see things a little bit bigger. I started the Big Bang, and I contextualize my life, I contextualize my breath, I contextualize my family and my generations, all within this very large framework of just being, we're anxious apes who like to wear clothes, which you could call drag. We're all born naked, the rest is drag. And we seek patterns and we seek narratives. So we're trying to put stories on all this stuff. And we seek connection, and we don't have a superhuman authority over us. It's just us and our societies and our intrinsic human morality. We are alive, we're free, we're autonomous. And that's with the asterisk on the bottom of that we're all affected, of course, by socialization, but I'm not going to focus on that part for this. And so you can take that slide down. I find that looking at things that way helps me find myself on the map, you know, like, you are here. This is, you know, the year 2020. You are here. There's going to be some more in the front. There's going to be some more in the back. And just because I'm alive now, it doesn't make this the most important part of the story. It doesn't make, you know, just because the day I was born, everything just went, you know, blank slate from here on. Anything that I see, that's a true story. Like, we have to understand that we are part of a larger story of our species and of existence in and of itself. And so being able to put yourself on that map, at least for me, gives me and I'm going to use a triggering word, it gives me a grace to allow myself to just be an animal, a beautiful, complex, loving, caring animal who messes up, but is complex and wonderful and can learn and can grow and can adapt. And I've never loved myself as much as I do now because I see myself on that map of here's where I am. Because I noticed that a lot of us, and it could be because of capitalism and American culture, if you're from America and you're exposed to that, that we hold these very, very high standards for ourselves, even post-religion. Like, I need to be good enough. I need to be pretty enough. I need to be skinny enough. I need to make enough money. I need to say the right things. I need to be a good enough ally. I need to say all the progressive things. And so we hold ourselves to these high, high, unrealistic standards that don't align with a worldview that is secular, because we are simply human. And so to be able to put yourself in that place and to realize what larger story you are a part of that has no plot, it doesn't have a plot. That's a little scary, but we are part of this large story, and it's beautiful, and we can give ourselves that grace to just be who we are. So for me, the way I lead my life is this is going to get you guys going. What I think the meaning of life is, It's not 42. I want it to be 42, but it's not. But I think that the meaning of life is to make this time, the experience of this timeline that we are in, as positive as possible for as many people as possible. I think that is the purpose to life. Like, I mean, that's the best that we can do with this timeline that we're just kind of thrown into, you know? So with that view, and I'm not asking anyone to agree with it, I'm just putting forth a thesis here, and you can disregard if you would like. But with that view, I developed this value system of autonomy that I keep in the front of my mind at all times. So like I mentioned before, if you check out at any point, all I'm saying is that you're autonomous and so is everyone else. And if that's true, how does that impact your behavior? So let's dig into that. The next slide you can put up is entitled A is for autonomy. A is for autonomy because we like the alphabet. So let's start with A. So A for autonomy. Autonomy is the capacity and the right to self-govern, making informed, uncoerced decisions. It's the ability to act on one's own values and interests. Everyone deserves autonomy. Not everyone's able to exercise autonomy due to external factors or lack of the sense of self-worth, self-respect, and self-knowledge, and a sense of what matters to them. And it is worth note here that lots of different social factors can limit the exercise of full autonomy, such as social class, gender, religion, race. And that's something that needs to be addressed. And you can take that slide down, but that's kind of my point, that if you are in a position where your ability to exercise your autonomy is being restricted or limited unethically, we need to fight against that. And that is why I think that everyone should consider how they can be involved in dismantling the systemic racism that we have in this country, in America. I don't assume that everyone's in America, but so that is kind of how I'm positing what autonomy is. And it's a complex idea, and philosophically a lot of people could kind of argue with what I've put forth there, and that's fair, but we're just going to kind of move forward with that. So I trust that you've all taken me very seriously and have gotten a piece of paper and a pen.
I've got mine right here.
We have.
Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, paper, pencil, Kleenex, your skin, I don't care. Like,
draw on your skin,
draw on your face so I know that you're super invested in it, you know? So if you would like to opt out of that, that's fine. If you're able to visualize it, that works too. There's no pressure here. But for those of you who do like to participate, who are kinetic learners or visual learners, this is going to pay off if you engage in this way. So what we're going to do is, if you have a piece of paper, let's say you've got, what are these called, A5 or A4 or something like that. A paper like that. So visually divide it in two lengthwise. And on the left side of the piece of paper, that'd be right for you, Australia. Just kidding. That's not how that works. On the left side, on the very top, I want you to draw like a house, just like a little stick figure house. And if you don't know how to do that, just draw a square, except leave the line on the top off, and then draw a triangle on the top. There's no artwork involved in this at all.
Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah.
Okay.
And now draw a perfect face. Just kidding. Don't do that. I'm just trying to.
I got one right here.
Just messing with you. So you drew a house.
Watch ourselves on YouTube if we sort of art skills.
No art skill required. So you drew the house. Now I want you to draw a little person inside. You can do a stick figure. If you're an artist, you can make it as detailed as you want. I don't care. Go nuts. I'll give you like 5 seconds. Yeah. How'd you do, Eric? How'd you do, Amaya?
Am I doing right?
Love it. Those look like people. I approve. Congratulations. Okay. And now under that house, I want you to write the word me. Spoiler alert. Me means you.
Oh, okay.
This is you. That looks good, Gail. I feel like this is fun. I like this. What I'm illustrating here is that little person is you, and we can call that your consciousness. We can call that your essence. We can call it whatever you want. I've debated people about what the word you means, but we won't get into that. But the point is that that person is you, and that house is are the things that you have autonomy over. That house belongs to you. You've not mortgaged it. You completely own it. You are sovereign over that house. So, yes, and I already said that part. So now I want to go into some examples of realms over which we have autonomy so that we're clear on that, because people's idea of autonomy might be different from person to person. So we can do this in a haphazard way, whatever you want to do, but basically what I'm going to ask you to do is write underneath that house examples of areas over which you identify having autonomy. Like, do you have autonomy over your thoughts? And we're going to take out of the equation, like, the idea of free will and if we really actually have free will or not. Just pretend that's not a thing. But just generally, what do you have autonomy over? And if you want to participate in any way, whether it's showing what you've written up on the screen, I'll try to pay attention. I can only see half of the participants, so I won't see everyone. Or if Eric and Amaya want to be our token participants.
Absolutely.
And they can type some of those things in the chat.
Oh, too. Yeah, use the comments too. Yep, I haven't watched that at all. So if people are writing to me, I'm sorry. I'm very engaged in what I'm doing here.
Oh, we got it. So yeah. I've got thoughts and feelings on here.
Yep. You're autonomous over your thoughts. You're autonomous over your feelings. That means that you are allowed to think what you want to think. You are allowed to feel what you want to feel, even though maybe you have a partner that yells at you like, how could you feel that way? Don't know what to tell you. I feel that way. That's how that is. Any other examples?
I have relationship model, religion or lack of religion, and mm-hmm. philosophical like positionings or opinions, or I don't know how to call it, but.
Yeah, exactly. One of the people's doing yard work and can't participate in that capacity. I validate that. And you know what? You have autonomy over that. So that works just fine.
Over the lawn?
You have autonomy over whether how you want to participate in this workshop. You don't have to write shit down. You can do whatever you want to do. So you can do yard work. Only the referee in me is autonomous. Yeah, Monty's getting philosophical. I feel you. Saying he's autonomous in how he loves, speaks, moves. And I'm acknowledging more people who are just listening in and not participating. That's totally cool. So if we move to the next slide, which has a bunch of bullets. So here are some examples that I wrote out of things that we have autonomy over, excluding that philosophical discussion about who's really in charge. Is there a homunculus inside of us? I don't know. But we have autonomy over our opinions, our feelings, our identity, whether it's our sexuality or our gender identity, over our sexuality in terms of like what Amaya said, our relationship structures, how we want to be in relationship with other people. We have autonomy over our bodies, whether we want to be touched, who we want to have sex with, where we physically want to go, how we want to move. We have autonomy over our time, whether we want to spend it doing hobbies or spending time with friends or different obligations. We have autonomy over our health, the decisions that we make around that. We have autonomy over our mind to an extent with self-awareness. We have autonomy over our information. So people shouldn't be sharing information about us without our consent. We have autonomy over our trauma in that we are not obligated to share our trauma with other people. So these all belong to you. You own these, and it would be unethical for another person to try to take them from you or coerce these from you, to tell you that you're not allowed to have that opinion, to tell you that you can't have that feeling, to say that your gender identity is invalid, to touch your body without your consent, to demand that you spend time with someone or get obligated to something else. Or for example, a very relevant example right now, a lot of white folks are going to black folks and almost requesting that they rehearse their trauma, their systemic racial oppression trauma to educate white people, and they don't need to do that. That is traumatic information for them, and we need to go a different route to get educated. So these are all things that are areas of autonomy for you. So for the next slide, you can bring that up, Eric. We're going to go back to the drawing exercise. We're not done with that piece of paper. And you can go ahead and draw or write down any of those words that resonated with you. Nope, there you go. So underneath that house, if you weren't able to think of any during that time that I prompted you. So the next drawing exercise, I want you on the right side of your paper, on the very top, to draw another person.
In a house?
Hold on, Eric.
Okay. Okay. I was really bad at following directions. Cool.
But yes, in a house.
Okay. Drawing another person.
Drawing another person in a house.
In a house.
Yep.
Right. I was really bad at art.
Looks good, Maya. And then underneath, you'll write everyone else. And now, if you did write anything on the left column where you were super excited about like all the ways that you're autonomous, now you get to copy those over to that side because you're autonomous and you get to have autonomy over those areas, and so does everyone else. I'm not going to make you write all of them. It's illustrative. So do as many as you need to get that into your brain.
Can we just write little arrows?
Yeah, make like a little ditto, just put ditto. It's a lot of work. I acknowledge that.
Well, you know, kind of writing for me helps get it stuck in my brain. And so
that's right.
I'm like, yeah. Really happy to just copy it.
Right. Yeah. So it's up to everyone and their preferred style of learning. So the next slide is really just a duplicate of the one I put up before, but it's basically illustrating that all those areas of autonomy that we just celebrated that we have, everyone else has those too. So it's easy to think about how, oh, I have a right to my own opinion. I have a right to my feelings, but we need to generalize that and realize that that's true for everyone else. So other people have the right to their feelings, to their opinions. Other people have a right to their identity, their sexual identity, their gender identity. There's the way that they, what's the phrase? Their sexuality. So if someone that you know is non-monogamous and it makes you feel icky, that's okay. You can feel icky, but if they're acting ethically, that's totally cool. And they get to do that. And everyone else has autonomy over whether they want to be touched or not. They have the right for that. So if you want to kiss someone and they say no, getting upset about it is getting upset that they have autonomy.
Hmm. Oh, wow. That's an interesting flip around.
What's easier to an easier way to look at that, because the feelings that we have when someone says, no, I don't want to kiss you, is fair. It's fair to feel hurt, but it's important to restructure why you're feeling hurt, because if you're angry at them, that means you're angry that they chose, that they got to choose what they wanted. Instead, like when I went through a breakup like a year ago, or whatever, and it hurt like hell. But I wasn't mad at them. I was sad because the thing that I wanted wasn't the same thing that they wanted. And so I was grieving. I was grieving that we didn't want the same thing.
Oh, but, so in a sense, like grief can turn in, like, and we learned about that several weeks ago, like grief can turn into anger, and kind of folks can express their grief through anger at times.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm in, that's going to vary for different scenarios, but in a case where someone is not wanting to meet you in a certain kind of a dynamic, they don't want to kiss you, they don't want to spend time with you or whatever, it could be easy to be angry at them because, I don't know, I think we take it personally. We're like, but but I want to come over to your house. I want to go and, you know, putz around in your kitchen. And I'm talking about these metaphorical houses that we're talking about, like, but I wanted to look in your kitchen. And they're like, yeah, but I don't want you to. And you get mad because they have the right to say no. So it's really important to try to recontextualize your emotional reaction to when someone declines to negotiate with you on their area of autonomy, to remember that they are exercising their autonomy. So when I went through that breakup, it was important to me to remember and to contextualize, to say, I am happy that he knows what he wants. I am happy that he said so. And I'm sad that we don't want the same thing, because I really wanted, you know, that relationship. And he doesn't, but he's autonomous. And so I'm going to make sure to own my grief and make sure to define it as that grief that we just don't want the same thing, instead of being angry at him.
Mm-hmm. I'm just reading someone posted in the comments something that I think is really good, is that you shouldn't make your kids give hugs and kisses to other people if you don't want to. And I think this is especially true with how us females are being brought up, because right now for me to say no to someone hugging me, which I don't mind hugging people, like, but you know, if I didn't want to, it would be so hard for me to say no. Like I feel like I have to like reconstruct myself into how to say no in a way that's not super hurtful for them, also healthy for me. It's something that we're really not educating in at all, like in any way, shape or form.
That's right. That's very, very true for women's bodies. And I'm sure for a lot of other bodies as well, that it's not easy to say no. And there are repercussions when we say no. And it makes it dangerous, and it makes us have to be delicate with other people's feelings, yeah, instead of knowing that it's right for us to manage our boundaries and to manage our autonomy in our spaces. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important experience of those who identify as women, and many other identities, I'm sure, are experiencing that as well. It's really problematic. So this is all, you know, a philosophical discussion, but clearly it's not, it's an ideal, but there's lots of things that are playing into this that reduce and limit our ability and our capacity to exercise that autonomy. And so that's kind of subtext there of like, mostly this is true, but there's a lot of nuances to it. Yes, so thank you for bringing that up. Someone wrote, so it's okay to grieve that someone doesn't want to meet us in the way we'd like. This is tricky to tease out after all the religious stuff. It is tricky. It's really tricky. And we're going to get into it, but what's really helpful is the skill that it's going to take to not have others' autonomous choices convert into anger inside of us is called, I don't know, Daryl could tell me if I'm wrong, but I call it emotion regulation, and blended with emotional intelligence. It requires a bit of self-awareness of being present with your feelings and kind of telling certain ones to be like, I see you, anger. I know you're not going to leave. I'm not going to kick you out, but I need you to go sit over here on the bench for a little bit, because I'm going to focus on making sure to contextualize this within an autonomous framework. You can be angry over here, but I'm going to focus my behavior through this lens. So I'm not telling anyone not to feel angry. Every feeling is valid. It's just a matter of developing the skills to manage those reactive feelings and then developing that skill to then choose how you're going to speak and how you're going to act. And that does require some therapy, some education, some practice. And that is not a thing I'm going to talk about today, because I am not a therapist. But yes, it does take a skill for sure. So I'm just kind of setting up the framework of things, but then there's going to be some skills that will need to be developed to manage those feelings. So yeah, and a commenter is saying that it's hard for adults who were sexually abused as children. Yeah. To use those boundaries. And yeah, absolutely. Just because I'm putting it out there is like, here's the boundaries, you need to lay it out, doesn't mean it's easy. Does not mean it's easy. But at least it gives you that framework to kind of understand maybe what to focus on in terms of your growth and what is appropriate, for the boundaries for you to set, and giving yourself that permission. Because I think some of that is about not feeling like you have the permission to set those boundaries, or caring too much about other people's hurt feelings and internalizing their feelings over valuing your boundaries in your body. I have a few examples there. Just like if someone tells you or you identify as non-binary, you are. Other people don't get to decide that. If your friend is polyamorous and that makes you uncomfortable, it doesn't matter. That's still how they identify. If they're acting ethically, then your opinion and your reaction has nothing to do with their house, their little body in that little house. They get to do what they want to. It's not your house. So anything that you feel is just a reflection of your values and your socialization. You go to a party and you want to leave, and you do leave, and your friend is pissed off that you left early. Autonomy. If you didn't want to stay there, you can set those boundaries and you can leave, and that's okay. And a lot of us have problems with that, being like, oh, I should stay. My friend wanted me to stay. And we have problems laying down those boundaries. And this is a great area to work on setting boundaries with other people and not apologizing when other people internalize it and get mad that you're setting boundaries, instead of celebrating the fact that you know that your house belongs to you and that you can set the boundaries that are appropriate to you. When people express anger over actions that you take that are completely appropriate for you to take, boundaries that are completely appropriate for you to take around things that are completely yours, you don't need to own that shit, because this is your house. So, and that again is going to take some emotional intelligence to allow yourself to release their anger and to not give in. I mean, if you want to negotiate, that's fine, but in general, to not cave in just because someone's upset. So the next slide is, so I've proposed to you that we all have autonomy, and that we, and that's great. So how the hell do we get anything done? If we all have autonomy, how does anyone get anything done? Remember that little house on the left side of your paper? Or if it's in your brain, remember what it looked like, that little house that was amazing. I know that you drew it super well in your head. What I want you to do is around the base of that house, like if it was on the plane of the grass, I want you to draw a dotted line in a circle. So like a halo, but it's on the ground, if that makes sense visually. It's a dotted line.
I'm pretty sure I'm doing it wrong, but let's hope not.
So it's a dotted line in a circle around the base of the house. Let's see what we got.
Yeah, how's this one?
Oh, you put it on the wrong one, but we're getting to it.
Oh, I start with me, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you're supposed to start with you. Yeah, so those dotted lines represent now a few things that I'm going to propose to you as means of how to make these houses work together. If everyone's so autonomous, how are we going to get shit done? Here's how we're going to get shit done. That dotted line for you represents your boundaries. And that's why it's dotted, because you get to, the dotted line kind of symbolizes some flexibility, some change, some nuance, open to change. And so that's why that dotted line is there. That represents the boundaries that you get to make for your house. And when I say your house, you get to see that bullet list of all those things that belong to you. You get to decide how you want people to engage with you, at least in the ideal, right? Clearly we've all experienced our autonomy being stepped over, our boundaries being stepped over, but in the ideal, that's what you get to do. You get to decide how you want to have interactions with people. And that's what that line represents. So you can go to the next slide, Eric. So boundaries, you can communicate limits and conditions for others' interactions with your autonomous realm, AKA boundaries. But again, back to that whole, like, we need to develop the skills to be able to do this. This is me just setting up the principles, but then there's the practice of it, the application, the lab work, if you will, of being able to set those boundaries. We need to develop in ourselves self-awareness and, very, very much importantly, respect for signals from our body and our feelings. A lot of us were gaslit in religion and have been conditioned to ignore signals from our body, signals from our feelings, especially those who were assigned male at birth were especially taught to ignore all feelings. And they are, a lot of those folks are dealing with a lot of toxic masculinity because of that. And that's really, really difficult to unpack. So that's not something I'm going to talk about in this particular talk, but we do need to work on that self-awareness so that we can actually listen to our bodies so that they can inform us what those boundaries are going to look like for us. And I'm not going to read through it, but on the right are a couple of tips to kind of inform you about like how to, what kind of framework to put that boundary setting in. It's our responsibility to communicate boundaries to other people. And I say that with some reservation clearly, but in general, it's our responsibility to let people know in that people can't read our minds. And so it's really important that we know ourselves, that we respect ourselves, and that we have the skills to tell people what we're comfortable with and what we're not comfortable with, and not apologize for it because we own this house. So let's go to the next slide. All right. So the next, slide is a skill that I learned when I was in therapy. And it's from, someone named Marsha Linehan, and she developed a therapeutic approach called the dialectical behavioral therapy. And this is one of the skills that she has, teaches in her curriculum, and it's called Dear Man, and it's an acronym. So just, but I'm only going to focus on the dear part of it. So just this, that's for context if you want to look this up later and learn more about it. But what I'm going to do now is kind of walk through one way of, pragmatically, like literally how to communicate a boundary, because I've spoken to you very philosophically, but what about like, okay, Marie, like, what are the literal words that I say? What's a formula of how I can put this together? So, dear man, I'm calling it dear man, but again, I'm only going to address the dear part. This is a way to put together how you're going to verbalize your boundary. So the first step is D, describe. So that means you describe the situation in very factual terms without any like emotions, just like explain, like, I came home, you were short with me and snapped at me, or I think that's pretty factual. And then you describe the situation. So then E is the part where you express how you feel. And I felt hurt that you snapped at me, for example. And you just express your feeling at that time. And then the A part stands for asserting. So you're asserting what your need is, or you're saying no to something depending on the situation at hand, but you're using language that affirms your autonomy and affirms their autonomy. And you ask for what you need. So maybe you're asking for a conversation, maybe you're asking them to give you space to talk about your day or whatever it is. You can use that opportunity to ask for what you need. And then the R is for reinforce. And that's where you can say, if you're able to do what I've asked for, this asserting of giving me space to talk or whatever, that's going to help me calm down, which is going to help me not to be so reactive, and which is whatever. And it's going to have this positive consequence. And you can explain that to them. Whereas like, if that's not a need that you can meet right now, I'm probably going to continue to be really stressed out for the rest of the evening. And I might need to take some space for myself, you know, like, so I'm blurring a lot of examples together, but the idea is to just kind of explain to them, like, here's what I would like, and here's what's going to happen if you're unable, not if you won't. If you won't is kind of like, that's language that sounds like, I reject the idea that you have autonomy in this scenario. It's more like, if you're able to meet my need, here's how I see things playing out. If you're unable to meet the need, here's kind of how I see it playing out. And it's not a way to manipulate them or give them an ultimatum. It's just explaining to them where you're at, what you need, and why, really, so that they can consider whether they can meet that need or not. So there's an example at the bottom, but we can swoosh past that. You can look up Dear Man, Marsha Linehan, for more information on that approach, because I went through it extremely quickly and my examples are convoluted. So you'll probably want to get more information on that. So now bring out your paper again. And Eric is ahead of us, but draw that dotted line around the everyone else house. Or if you're doing it in your mind, draw it in your mind. Go grab your little homunculus in your head and have him grab a pen and just draw a line around the base of the house there. And this is the reminder that as fun as it is to think about telling people how they can and cannot interact with us, we also have to keep in mind that other people get to do that too. The other people get to tell you whether they want you to touch them or not. They get to say no. They get to say, no, I don't want to date you anymore. They get to say, no, I don't want to be your friend anymore. And when we interact with that kind of an experience and we say, he rejected me, and we use language like that, it rejects the very notion that they have autonomy, the very notion that they could possibly want anything that doesn't have to do with you. So when you're interacting with people, try to remember that other people have that dotted line, that they have the right to decide how they're going to engage with you, and to make sure to contextualize that when you feel grief about not having the same desires as someone else. If you desire being with someone else and they don't desire being with you, make sure to try to contextualize your grief in that way, that they're just being autonomous and it has nothing to do with you, that you're okay. You are okay. So the next thing I want you to draw is a dotted line from the my house, the me house, over to the everyone else house. And when you get to the everyone else house, I want you to make an arrow at the end of that dotted line. So the dotted line starts at the my house and it ends in an arrow at the everyone else house.
All right, did I do it right this time?
Yeah. You totally got it. Yours has an arc too. That's like projectile. That's awesome. So what that symbolizes is something that we're going to get into now called consent. So if boundaries is that dotted line around your house and around their house, then consent is the dotted line that goes from your house to their house. It's you proactively inquiring around the boundaries of someone else. So, you know, someone can start by expressing boundaries, or you can go ahead and ask, can I hug you? That's you inquiring around the boundaries. You don't know. You don't know what the boundaries are at that house. So before you do it, you ask, because you know that touch and body is an autonomous right. And so you ask first, you follow that dotted line and you ask if you can hug them. And if they say yes, you get to hug them. If they don't, you get to celebrate the fact that they know that they're autonomous and that they know whether or not they want to be touched or not. And it doesn't need to be about you. And you can celebrate the fact that you sought consent and that you respected their autonomy and you respected their boundaries. So that's what the consent line is for. And you can even draw a line going back, right? So a dotted line from everyone else's house to your house with an arrow going to your house. And that represents people coming to you and asking you, would you like to date me? Would you like to hold my hand? Someone asks you, and again, I think we're going to kind of tap into comments I've already seen in the chat here about, like, if you have a history of sexual abuse as a child, it's hard. Even when people come to you and ask for consent, it can be difficult to express those boundaries the way that you know that they are inside of you. And that's something to definitely explore with a therapist, about getting more comfortable expressing your boundaries in a scenario where you feel pressured, but you're not actually pressured. It's just kind of old trauma playing out. Again, not a therapist. So that's something to explore there. But whenever in doubt, ask yourself, do I have autonomy? Do they have autonomy? Yep. So use that to act conservatively and prioritize another person's autonomy over your desire to, you know, cross their boundaries. And remember to focus on your home and your boundaries and your boundaries, your home, your boundaries, and seek that consent from other people and kind of keep that bullet list that we looked over in the very beginning. Keep that bullet list in the front of your mind. You know, what are you saying to people when you say, "I can't believe you're sad"? Don't be sad about that. Why are you crying? What are you saying to people? That they shouldn't feel those feelings. They shouldn't be sad. They can't be sad. It's not right to be sad. What we're doing is we're looking into their home and they're saying, you don't get to put the scissors over there. And they're like, "Dude, it's my house. I get to put the scissors wherever I want." I like to think about things linguistically. So when you're going to approach someone to inquire around a consensual issue, the way to frame your language is in a framework of non-possessiveness, knowing that you don't own their house. A non-judgmental perspective, meaning that you accept any outcome of that that inquiry of consent. Clarity, making sure you're being clear about what you're asking for. Working in tiers. So just because someone said yes to kiss you does not mean they said yes to having sex with you. So making sure to incrementally explore consent. And it's just a nice little cherry on the top. If when someone exposes a boundary to you, shares something with you, shares about their trauma, shares about their history of racial oppression, an acknowledgement of, "Wow, thank you. You didn't have to open up your home to me. You didn't have to show me all of this. You let me in. And I acknowledge that." That's a lot of vulnerability and willingness. And thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because we don't have the right to that information, yet they shared it because they trusted us or they wanted to. So the next slide, I love the examples at the bottom. I'm glad you're able to read it so fast. So the next slide is, again, one I'm going to have to go through pretty quickly, but this is the, the third element of how, if we're all autonomous, how are we going to get anything done thing is negotiation. So we've got boundaries, we've got consent, and that kind of helps us lob back and forth. But then we kind of need to get into the skill, and this is a skill, of developing an ability to negotiate, and especially negotiating with a linguistic framework of acknowledging that the other person has complete and total autonomy over their choices, and that you do too. And that's going to kind of de-escalate a lot of things if you go into the scenario with that already presumed. We have to be careful about not using negotiation to manipulate people and to be like, "Oh, you don't want to kiss me? Well, what if I just like poked your arm?" Like, you know, it gets a little manipulative in that way. So negotiation is really something more like, if it's unclear and you're in a safe relationship and you're just trying to refine exactly what the two of you are actually trying to discuss and trying to be like, "Okay, you know, I don't want to have kids." And it turns out if you talk it out a little bit further, they actually just didn't want to birth their own child. And so then boom, they're actually able to go adopt and foster or whatever. But if you don't kind of get in there and figure out exactly what's behind all of that, you could lose an opportunity. It's a tricky area for sure. To make sure not to stay away from gaslighting and not taking a no as a final answer. There's a lot of nuance in that I can't explore in this discussion, but negotiation regardless is an important skill. So then I've got a slide about examples of negotiation. I just want to show you what it can look like in a healthy context. So for example, you have a partner who you love spending time with and you've never spent a day apart from them, and they're going on a week-long trip to a fantastic state like California. And you're noticing you're feeling a lot of like jealousy and sadness, like they're going to get to enjoy this trip with someone else and you just wish that you could go. And so you can use that dear man skill. You can see that I use a D-E-A-R to kind of illustrate the parts of that construct of the conversation to explain, "You're going on a trip with your friend to California next month while I stay home. Emotions. I'm concerned I'm going to struggle with jealous feelings during that week, and that will put stress on our relationship. So I'm asserting I would like to deconstruct this fear I'm having." And "I would like to deconstruct this fear" is owning my feelings and not asking them to manage my feelings for me. So And then, so then you can ask for things that you need and negotiate between the two of you to find a way to get your needs met while respecting the autonomy of the other person. So you can read through that as an example. And so then just the last few slides I want to quickly hit on is, what if they say no? What if they say no, entirely no? And we've kind of touched on this already. You know, you've explored negotiation with them. You've gone through your dear man thing. You were respectful. You asserted autonomy for yourself and for the others. And they still said no. In that position, it can be challenging to back out of the conversation gracefully because you feel like you did everything right and you didn't get what you wanted. But the thing about doing everything right is to do it because it's right and not because you're expecting it to get the outcome that you wanted. What we're doing here is keeping autonomy in the front of our mind, our autonomy and their autonomy. And so if they've made it clear what their position is, that's the point where we need to use these skills that we're going to develop in therapy to manage that feeling that we have of grief, of not getting a need met, of creativity, of finding another way to get that need met. If someone else can't do it or they don't have time for it or whatever, who else are we going to go and talk to if that person doesn't have time? So we need to take responsibility for that. So that's what we do if they say no. We have to walk away gracefully and take care of our own needs. The next slide is, what if I fucked up? And I'm sorry for anyone who's sensitive around language. I swear a lot. So what if I gosh darn screwed up? Well, my advice is to make sure not to center it on you. Like if you crossed a boundary, you didn't listen, you fucked up. Make sure not to center it on you, because what you did was crossing a boundary. And it's much more helpful if we can accept that as soon as possible, own up to that, and immediately default back into that position of respecting the autonomy of the other person. So we need to center back on them and their autonomy over their body. Our priority, even when we fuck up, it's an opportunity for us to reset and reprioritize and honor the autonomy of the other person and their boundaries. Our priority is not to keep our ego intact. And we need to honestly evaluate where it was that we misstepped and accept and expect and honor if the person on the other end whose boundaries you violated might need to step away from the relationship, even if in a small capacity, a temporary capacity, a permanent capacity. If someone does that to us, it might be easy to be reactive, to be angry, to lash out at them. But in the end, if we cross a boundary, they're now changing that boundary to protect themselves, and that's okay. And so we need to try to learn from our mistakes instead of doubling down and lashing out at the people that are protecting themselves and their own boundaries. So that's my advice around that, because we are going to all fuck up. I fucked up this week. I fucked up pretty bad. I've been trying to get educated on racism, and I made some missteps because I wasn't educated well enough. And everything inside of me wanted to double down and say, well, you know, I was doing my best or whatever. But in the end, at the front of my mind is that I want autonomy and equality for everyone. So I could have doubled down and I could have been one less person that was in the fight because of my ego. Or I could have prioritized, and this is what I'm trying to do, prioritize the fight for equality over my feelings. And that's hard. That's hard emotional work. And again, that's some stuff that we need to work on in therapy or wherever else, whatever kind of venue can provide that work for you. So, I mean, with that heavy, with that heavy note, that's basically the presentation. Autonomy is essential. And the way that we work through that is through boundaries, consent, and negotiation. And then there's a bunch of different tips for handling how that feels in the end, how those conversations feel. So as just a last little note, this workshop is constantly a work in progress. I've been teaching it for about a year, and I made a lot of changes to it today after what I've been educated on about anti-racism. So I'm constantly trying to improve it. So I'm happy to take any feedback. I'm also very comfortable encouraging you to take what works and leave the rest. This is just a personal experience kind of workshop, and it might not resonate with everyone. It might not be true for everyone. So I hope that you were able to find something of value for yourself here. And I look forward to any cues that you all have that I can attempt to A.
Marie, this was so good. Thank you so much. I'm looking through the chat, and there was such positive response to it. It's just fantastic. Like Amaya said, we've got some questions for you that were sent to us privately or put into the chat. So Amaya, you want to take it away?
Sure. I really want to take the first one because it's about ethical non-monogamy and polyamorous. And I recently had an incident with someone that made me, I think, set a boundary, but I'm not sure if I did it correctly. So maybe you can tell me, Marie. So basically, I was debating, because apparently my relationship style is a debatable topic. I was debating with someone about polyamory. And they said that, apart from other bunch of stupid stuff, that it leads to mass violence. So I got really angry. And I decided that I'm going to stop engaging in debates like that because, you know, as a mental health like protector kind of thing, I just don't want to deal with that at all. So I just wanted to insert my little experience with that. There, maybe someone in the chat can relate to it. Or
so they said polyamory causes violence,
mass violence, not just violence, mass violence.
Specifically mass violence.
Yes. Yes, and it has been proven in countries in which polyamory is like more normalized. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that's not true. So, I don't know if I would ever like debate. I mean, I would be like, cool. Could I have like this, you know, links to those stories? Because that sounds very curious. Because my guess, like immediately I was like, if anything, my guess is those are like more like polygamous, like hierarchical, misogynistic types of non-monogamous situations. And that's the thing, that most people feel icky about non-monogamy because they relate it to those kinds of hierarchical non-monogamous relationships that you're usually only seeing in like Mormons and stuff. However, when you engage in ethical non-monogamy, that shit's not happening because it's ethical, it's open, it's consensual, people are talking, people are taking care of each other. The only reason I'm here talking about autonomy, to be honest, is because of everything that I learned in understanding non-monogamy and how that works, because you don't have to play by the set of rules anymore. You can just protect each other and work with each other as one-on-ones instead of following this like escalator path of like, here's what you have to do, you know, what's expected out of you. And now you can just deal with people as individuals and meet them where they're at and find out what their boundaries are, what their needs are, what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. So no, I have not seen any mass violence caused by polyamory, but that's okay.
Thank you for confirming that for all of us. Everybody suspected that it leads to mass violence, but now we have the confirmation
that they might be getting that confused with BDSM because like that's not violence, it's just sex.
But anyway, I was just telling my little story, but the question that someone asked was, what does ethical non-monogamy mean? And what are some other things under that umbrella? I know this doesn't necessarily have that much to do with the topic of autonomy, but I mean, it has
everything to do with it. It's another example of it. And like I try to keep on weaving in, our initiatives against anti-racism have everything to do with autonomy too. But ethical non-monogamy, and I should have defined that earlier when I brought it up, but ethical non-monogamy is an umbrella of all types of non-monogamy, which are having relationships with more than one person at a time or being open to that philosophically, but in an ethical way. So mm-hmm. everyone knows there's an agreement, everyone discusses, nothing is happening that isn't in the air, there's no cheating. It's very open and very well discussed and a lot more open than a lot of monogamous relationships I've seen in terms of interpersonal communication. not to poo-poo monogamy. I'm just saying that, like, in general, it's not set up that way, unless the people are exemplar, which I'm looking at the screen and clearly you're all exemplar and don't apply at all. But so ethical non-monogamy is that umbrella. And then a lot of things can fit under there as long as they're ethical. That, I mean, it fits under there. So, like, for me, I consider myself polyamorous. Polyamorous means that I'm open to loving more than one person at a time. A lot of people who explore non-monogamy just, and I don't want to use the word just, but their interest is more sex. And so they might be swingers or whatever. Like, as long as it's ethical and everyone is being protected, it fits under that umbrella. There's a lot of couples that engage in something called monogamish. That's an ISH at the end of monogamish, which means that, like, every 3 months or so, they might invite someone into their bedroom for fun. And so they're mostly monogamish, except for quarterly. So everything fits under that umbrella as long as it's ethical.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Marie. We've got another question, and it's kind of relating to how would one stay with a partner or spouse that doesn't seem to care about your needs? And so that kind of relates a little bit to autonomy, and that's a tough question to answer right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, I am a coach, so I could help you with that. But it's up to everyone. It's up to all of us to decide what we're willing to put up with or have in our relationships. And so whoever this is needs to decide if this is tolerable. Is there any room for growth or adaptation or negotiation at all? If there's not, then you have to ask yourself what kind of relationship this is. And if you're still okay being in it, I'm not going to judge you. You just keep hanging in there. And if you're disappointed, and that's just kind of what the life is like is for you, that's totally, everyone gets to decide what they're willing to, you know, quote unquote, put up with. I don't mean to say it like that, but, you know, I was in a marriage for 5 years because that was what was important to me. And I wouldn't leave because that was what my values were, even though it was not a good relationship for me until I kind of hit a certain point where I was like, this is just not working anymore. So everyone needs to kind of be on their own path when it comes to that and ask themselves, you know, are your boundaries being crossed too much? And that's that self-awareness of, like, is this too much? Is this too much? Or can I handle it a little bit longer? Or is there anything I can do? Or do I need to leave? Do I need to leave this? I don't have an easy answer for that. It's really up to everyone to query themselves and to consider whether their partner is open to dialoguing more about whatever this need is or whatever the problem is in the relationship, and if they're willing to negotiate on it or talk about it at all. And if they're not, personally, I would be very disinterested in a partner who is not willing to talk about any of this. Like, even if they were just like, I hear what you're saying, I can't do it, I don't know if this is going to work. But instead, they kind of put down this foot down thing, like, no, you can't do it, I don't want it, this is the way that it is. And then they kind of end up being a dictator in the relationship. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to be in that for very long.
Yeah. Then, you know, one other thing to consider is this is, in my view, the only life we really have. And it's not like we're going to get to do it again. Amaya, got another question?
Yeah. So we have a question related to anti-vaxxers, which I think this is so interesting. So it says, for decades, anti-vax activists have used the bodily autonomy argument to deft government directives around the world, and this is getting worse. Recently, the same argument is being made against directives to wear masks. What are your thoughts on this?
That's tough. I don't think you're going to get a strong opinion from me, because I feel that one, and I feel how complicated it is. And it's like trying to imagine a world where you force people to have vaccines doesn't seem great either. Like, yeah, they have bodily autonomy, but with their bodily autonomy, they're jeopardizing the health of everyone else. I don't know how to solve that one. I don't. That's my answer. I don't know.
Yeah, there is this weight or this value we have to put between autonomy and the greater good. And should some autonomy be given up in order for the society to be healthier and thrive more? That's kind of something that we really have to consider and think about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's complicated for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, Amaya, do you have any other questions you want to ask? Or
I can ask one more if we have time, or are we running out of time?
Yeah, one more, I think it'll be great.
Okay. So can you set a boundary for yourself without communicating with other people? So in the context of when you don't know the other person so well, or maybe you think they're going to react badly, because I know a lot of, for example, like teenagers, when they're living with their parents, they may think that their parents are not going to be very well receptive of verbal boundaries. Is it a possibility to set up a boundary that's not necessarily verbal? It's more like, I'm just going to disengage, I'm going to leave the room, or something like that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think what I've been illustrating is I've been framing it through a verbal frame. But you're right that, and thank you for bringing that up, because boundaries don't always need to be communicated verbally. Like even within sex, a lot of things can be communicated, and this is a complicated assertion that I'm making, I know, but to an extent within sex, some things can be communicated with your body. You can, you know, grab their hand and put it here, and that's saying, you can do that, you know, and I don't have to say, I autonomously declare that you may put your hand here and squeeze for 2 minutes. Like, you know, so there's some nuance there. There is, and that's a fun example, but like, the example there, just walking away. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't owe an explanation to anyone. Thank you for clearing out that, because yeah, you don't have to, what we're talking about right now, in terms of like Dear Manning and stuff, is emotional labor. We're exerting emotional labor to engage in an interpersonal dialogue of trying to manage these two autonomous beings, and how we're going to work together. And it's an opt-in. It's an opt-in to engage in that. It's a trust and an investment in that other person to even have that dialogue. Whereas you don't owe that to everyone, though. Thank you for pointing that out. You can walk away. You can just fucking walk away. You can disengage. You can block. And that's the beauty of boundaries, that you get to decide even how you're going to express that boundary. So if you have a shitty dad and he's just straight up shitty, you don't need to email him and be like, I would like to inform you that I will be blocking you and blah, blah, blah. Some of us might do that. But you don't have to. You can just, that's the thing. It's up to you. It's up to you. And if later you regret how you did it and you're rethinking it and you want to go back and try something different, you can do that. We're humans. So we don't have to be like, we don't have to commit to things like we did when we were religious. We can be wrong. We can back up. We can redo. We can negotiate. We can apologize and we can change our minds. So yeah, you can definitely just block someone, walk away, do something that's less engaged. Absolutely.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much. I really like this session. I thought it was very practical and very like, hands-on or very like visual. So it was really amazing, Marie. Thank you so much.
Good.
I really enjoyed it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.